responded to all questions. I know she hasn't even touched Dee Schaefer's question. Have it, Madam Sarah.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson, and thank you to Honourable Members for again for the questions. The last question from Honourable Jeffrey was whether or not we're going to get any cut in our budget. In this particular financial year, we were asked to also make a reduction, even though we are the least, one of the least funded institutions, together with other church lands. And we indicated that we could cut 360,000 but redirect it to something else. In other words, cut from something but redirect it to some of the money that we ourselves were asking for, because we had asked for additional funding for this year alone. Yes. In the next financial years, no, we have pleaded not to receive any cut, because as we stand at the moment, this institution, which is supposed to be accessible to all persons and communities in terms of Section 182.4, has up until now operated on its inception budget. Because when it was created, it had an inception budget, and then up until now it has just been getting 10% increases. It has never been reviewed in line with the fact that as an institution it became a full-fledged institution. But more importantly, Honourable Jeffrey, you will note that since its inception, it then got additional powers beyond the traditional ombudsman powers. Ordinarily, a country would have a different institution for its executive members ethics act, which has a 30-day deadline. There was never a budget for that. We were just given an inflation increase like everyone else gets an inflation increase. When we got the prior mandate, which of course is going to be taken away, and we're glad about that, there was no additional money. The PDA, the promotion, the Housing Measures Protection Act, where we review the decisions of the Home Builders Registration Council, was never accompanied by a budget. The POCA mandate was never accompanied by a budget. So we've been engaging with Treasury to say we honestly do need an increase. We believe that when the Constitution says the public protector should be accessible to all persons and communities, it really is giving people a right to access to justice via this institution for the purposes of administrative improprieties of the state. And for us then, it falls under the actions that the state has to pay attention to in terms of Section 237 of the Constitution, where it says constitutional responsibilities should be performed diligently and without delay. So that is our plea. The DG from Treasury said he will do his best, but everyone is tightening their belts. So it is an engagement, but both Justice and Treasury have indicated that they are concerned that we do need additional resources to be able to help the state appropriately to highlight deficiencies in terms of governance, so that the money can be saved, because the money that the state is going to give us will be saved when we continuously show the state where are you losing money, such as, for example, false billing, companies that shouldn't be getting tenders, being given those tenders and therefore not delivering, as we've seen in the RTP housing program. And then when the state has to recover, it can't recover, instead it has to pay more, as we've seen again the RTP program, where billions are now being paid back because there wasn't proper diligence, due diligence at the beginning. So we think we can add value to the state. At the end of the day, the additional money that we're requesting will be recovered by the state through our contribution in ending systemic maladministration. And that is our hope and prayer. So if I had to answer that. The Honourable Shaytham, I sincerely apologize. We are now working with the team to look at what happened. We did promise that we'll give you responses to all of those questions that were asked and to give you a template on all of the investigations that we're involved in. I do know that my in-text assessment and customer service manager just after that was translated to Joburg, and then, but it's, I take responsibility because it was my job to make sure that there's a proper transfer from the one manager to the other. I will make sure that we get to and to the other parties that emerge in the coming week. But let me say, honestly, Honourable Shepherd, by Friday we'll make sure, and to the other parties that also had matters where they wanted. But on the issue of a systemic investigation on maintenance, we have agreed to do that one, and I just apologize that we never wrote back to you. It was discussed in our assessment committee. Just going back again to the question that was raised by Honourable it wasn't honourable, but that whole question about what does that committee do, they really are our engine room in terms of looking at what we should investigate and what should be our investigation strategy. They also pick up trends. They're the ones who also pick up trends as we do those trends and then indicate what should be the subject of a systemic investigation based on the fact that there is a lot of problems that seem to come from that direction. On the question of the police, Honourable Shaver, a lot of the complaints that we take from the police are only the ones that don't belong to the IPERT. We do receive them, the ones that are police misconduct, police brutality, etc. And then we submit them to the IPERT. The ones that we normally investigate are the ones that you're talking about, that are talking about the service failure. A lot of them have to do with people saying they didn't get the matter was not investigated. But there's also another worrying trend that we would like to look at from a systemic point of view, but maybe not immediately, but maybe early next year, because our hands are full. Is increasingly we're getting people that say that they reported a matter, but it's not showing on the police figures, which then brings problems around crime statistics if it's true. But we don't want to make a finding on it, and I don't want to promise we'll do it in this year 2012-13, because it's just not going to be possible with the RDP investigation that we're involved in at this stage. We will not be able to add any more systemic investigations. But that is one of the ones that we may want to look at next year.
So are you specifically referring to the steps or you know, including things like not taking the statements properly and not investigating properly?
Honourable Chafer, the complaints that we have received, they would include not taking the statement properly, but most of the complaints we get are failure to investigate. Most of the complaints are that it wasn't investigated. It's quite interesting, one of the complaints I got last week was a policeman himself who was saying they didn't investigate his own matter, he fired his own partner, and it wasn't investigated, and then they said he wanted the person who had stolen from him arrested, and there was insufficient evidence, but he was saying, what evidence? Because he himself has a whole lot of people, but nobody came to him to get the evidence. So we get a lot of those. And then we get those who are saying we reported the matter, but it's not on the record. It's not accounted for. I'm saying, Honourable Shaver, it's something we're considering looking at possibly in the coming year, not this year, but it is something that we have to discuss in our tripartite meeting with the IPERT and the police civilian secretariat, because we need to know whether they are aware of the same patterns and what are they doing from their side before we then decide whether we want to go systemic, because they may be doing a systemic already on the same problem. So we also have to have a second meeting with them, so we'll delineate what are they doing and what should we be doing. We are concerned about these matters, but we don't have capacity yet. And if they are taking care of them, then we might not have to take care of them. Right. Thank you. Which departments do not cooperate? Perhaps we should submit a separate report, Honourable Shaver, on which departments give us problems, so that this committee can assist us, because that also impacts on our capacity. It takes 10 letters to and 50 phone calls to one department to just get a response. That means we're working on them, we're over investing in that process, Honourable Chairperson. Whereas those departments that respond immediately, we invest less in the process. We normally have our first letter to them is to inform them we're investigating, and then it is also a document request letter. Our first letter is to tell them we're investigating and we're requesting this document and any information. Then later we'll request meeting. For some of them, it really is difficult to get them to just give you that document. Then there are those, like the one that I spoke to yesterday, which I was not disclosed, that was saying, since we are, let's say, no, we don't fall under your jurisdiction. We are also a constitutional structure, and you can't ask her questions. You are a super government. Why should we answer you? And the truth is, as I have indicated previously, a traffic officer asks all of us questions. That doesn't make him our boss. It just makes him the person who's been asked by the law to ask us questions. And that's the same role as the public protector. So those give us problems because then we have to have meetings and sometimes subpoena them. We got one that said, before you subpoena, you should discuss diaries with us. And they said so in writing. That was last week as well. So they said, lawyer drafted this letter. It was either by appointment, and it was in writing. We were shocked, yes, and then said, no, we're doing a special event for our department, so we can't come to the subpoena. And
which department?
And they didn't have.
Which department?
I'm not going to say. Oh, no,
all right.
No, because we've got to talk to them quietly. We normally use force, soft power first before we use hard power, if they give us trouble again. Because we said, I said to my CEO, please speak to your counterperson, tell him his lawyer didn't go to the right law school. You don't subpoena him by appointment. And because the strategy probably just signed in a hurry. In fact, he didn't sign it himself. He signed the person. So I don't think it would be fair to disclose who it is. But if they do give us problems, we'll report that. But I do promise, though, that before the end of, maybe by January, we will give a compliance report, because we're having a compliance office appointed in the next month or so, so that we don't mention some and exclude others, and then people feel that we are selective. It's better to have a comprehensive report where if we're going to name and shame, then we equally do so. Then you asked us, honourable members, about systemic investigations. We're doing one on RCP houses. We will request an opportunity, honourable members, to come here and table the voices and views report, what we saw and what we heard. And that's for your attention. It was the voices and views reports that were sent to the provinces for each province have been sort of well received, because the mayors, MSs and premiers immediately said some of those problems they are aware of, and many of them they are already dealing with. So we then asked they should maybe then create action plans to handle the matter that they concede their problems and indicate what they are doing. And from our side, they will deal with those that involve allegations of corruption, false billing, and all sorts of conduct failures. And then we're also looking at an investigation into alleged illegal conversion of taxi, of illegal conversion of tunnel vans into taxis. That's one of the ones that we've been doing public hearings on. And we are looking at, in the Eastern Cape, there's a systemic investigation into conditions of grade R practitioners. In Gauteng, there's an investigation into UIF benefits. We're also looking again at workers' compensation. We did a systemic investigation into workers' compensation. And then workers' compensation, unlike SASA, doesn't seem to have used those lessons and addressed the problems. We still have problems of people who haven't been paid for more than 5 years, which is very sad, because some of them would be now out of work and without any money at all. And yet there was a systemic investigation before I came. If you contrast them with SASA, SASA there was a systemic investigation and there were recommendations on measures to be taken. And they implemented those measures. We get very few complaints from SASA. They have checklists on what forms they need. And they have proper systems on how to manage their processes. And so we have conversation is quite a problem in this regard. We're also doing one with the family advocate, men complaining that they're not getting their treatments from the family advocate's office. So, well, if people complain, they have to be.
But I beg it, Madam Sarah, why do you find it amusing? Why do you find it amusing?
Say I find it amusing, Honourable Chairman, because Honourable Member, the body language was suggesting maybe it's not an area we should be handling. From us, if people complain and there is repeat complaints from that area,
so you the
then we have to do it. So we are working on it because there is a complaint, and there is also an area that we haven't started a systemic investigation, but we've identified it is a master's office, particularly the Guardian Fund, but also administration of estates in general.
That's the one that asked for more details, is it?
Yes. Thank you, Honourable Members. We've given you this one on the top of what we could pick up, but I think the best thing is that we will ask our IACS, our intake assessment and customer service office to just present a proper template. Our intake assessment and customer service office, they are responsible for the core casework from beginning to end and right up to customer service from a management point of view. And we will then submit that. Honourable Schaefer, your last question was municipalities. Are the complaints on matters that are within their mandate? Some are not. For example, members of the public don't always know who is responsible to provide them with an RCD house. So some of the complaints would say a municipality has not provided me with a house, whereas the ones that are not metros are not really the ones responsible. It is actually at the level of the Department of Human Settlements. Some of the complaints also against municipalities would be access to jobs. Apart from the complaints, they're saying the municipalities themselves are giving jobs on the basis of favoritism, be it political favor or some other favor. But there are complaints about jobs where people are just saying we don't have jobs and we're not being provided. So economic underdevelopment, they complain against the municipality, whereas it's not a municipality. Some of the health issues that they complain about, some are within the municipality's jurisdiction, but most of them are not in the municipality's jurisdiction. Police services are not in the municipality's jurisdiction. And some of the complaints are not within the municipality's jurisdiction. But as a public protector, unlike a court, when you complain to us and you mention one institution that is not the right institution, we don't reject it and say you complain against the wrong person. We look at the complaint and say, you said you're complaining against the Department of Public Works, and then we find that actually it should be the Department of Transport. We investigate it according to who we know is responsible for that service, not the one that was mentioned in the complaint. So our assessment process redirects the way we end up reporting the complaint. So it would not be against the municipality if the matter does not involve the municipality. It would put to the right person. Honourable Mujake wanted to know what is our major obstacle to finalising cases. In my presentation I said there were two major problems. The one is our capacity constraints. We have set ourselves the objective of making sure that our investigations are swift and thorough and no compromise on either of the two. And then thorough means we're doing more of the kind of work that the Mail and Guardian case wanted us to do. You don't just inquire and then close shop on the basis of an inquiry. You actually go and dig and talk and a lot of field work. So that takes a little bit more of our resources on complex investigations. But we have also simplified our procedures on early resolution letters, which gives us more hands, though, more time, because our early resolution letters, instead of writing lots of letters, we're now resolving them primarily through meetings. round the table discussions, which make it faster. So we may have some of the time, but still we don't have enough resources. The second reason, Honourable Jeff said, Honourable Chake, she's gone.
Yes.
The second reason was that is that some departments don't give answers on time, or sometimes we get flippant answers and then we have to dig digging and digging. So if we would get more cooperation from departments, some of the cases would be resolved. Honourable Machake wanted to know the distribution of the cases that have not been finalized. Honourable Machake said we finalized only about 50% of our cases in the past year. We actually finalized more than that because we received 20,000 cases last year and new cases that we received last year, and we finalized 16,000 something. That is more than 60% of the cases that we received. However, we had inherited more than 5,000 cases from the previous year, which then made our caseload 27,000. But even if our caseload was 27,000, we still concluded far more than 60% of the cases. And our productivity increased because we concluded more cases in this year that we're talking about than the previous year. But still, again, it's not enough for the people whose cases have been rolled over because they also deserve speedy justice. Then lastly, some of the cases that were not finalized in that year is because they were received shortly before we closed shop. That's what I also explained, is that some of the cases, when we've had a huge outreach event, we get a lot of cases. So if we get those cases in March and we're closing shop at the end of, closing books, on the 31st of March, so there would be a huge carryover, but it really is a book kind of carryover. It doesn't mean we didn't attend to them. It means they were just they arrived then and they were recorded shortly before we closed our books. Okay, I have already answered the question of having too many intake workers. The interesting thing is that I just got a request from the intake assessment and customer service team requesting more people. The figures were confusing because we only gave the figures where the intake team acts as almost an investigator themselves. Remember, all of the cases that went through head office, they went through the intake assessment and customer service team. So the entire caseload for head office would have been processed through the intake assessment and customer services team. And then in terms of supervising all of our intake processes, they take care of the whole national thing. So all we dealt with there was the ones where they assessed and had to resolve them themselves. So those cases are not going to be reflected in the branches because they were concluded in intake and assessment. And to balance our books, all of the cases that came through had to be reflected on the distribution of cases in terms of the various units. I hope that will be explained to Honourable Machake. She also wanted to know what we're doing to harmonize case distribution, which is something I have already addressed by indicating that we are looking at making sure that those with a bigger caseload get more people. But also with Gauteng, we made a decision that no new cases that came to national will be given to Gauteng simply because they belong to that province. We will deal with them ourselves at national until we've sorted out the capacity problems in that province. Honourable Mr. also wanted to know which are the municipalities that we have on the list. We will be able to provide that information if we can be given until next week Friday, where the team is going to pull out the actual names of the municipalities, where we sit under municipalities. At the same time that we're going to provide you, the justice one, you said we should try and provide it by Monday. We are going to do so. And then going forward, we will make sure that we provide information on all of them regarding the systemic issues that arose from that group. I've answered the question that we didn't lose 5 million. The CEO and the CFO are going to respond to that. that it is a book, it is an accounting issue that is talking to your deficit, and I have explained that that deficit is based on the leasing problem, but the CEO is going to provide further information, and the CFO may also assist. Then Honourable Jackie also wanted to know whether we had rolled over any of our finances last year. Did we have any money that was rolled over this year? I do know that we did roll over the money that was given to us towards the end of the financial year for additional investigation capacity. The time we had was not enough to employ new investigators with a view to dealing with the backlog, because we wanted to deal with the backlog. Instead, then we opted for to outsource those cases, and the process then took a little while in outsourcing that. And we asked for the money to roll over, and then we outsourced at the beginning of this year. Honourable Chairperson, I already answered Honourable Smart's concerns around the health and thank her for the fact that she likes the title. Thank you. I will tell the team that they like.
I mean, I think the issue on the lease, I think it's understandable, but I mean, maybe they can, and particularly because my colleague is not here.
Mm.
But just a few more specific ones. On page 3, slide 3, I don't know if you can just go to it, but the figures don't add up. You said you had 5,603 complaints carried over from the last financial year. You received 20,626 new complaints. That adds up to 26,229 in total, but yet you say you investigated 27,376. There's something wrong there with those figures, and there's about 1,000 complaints. But anyway, that's one. Then the other is the document referred to in Section 311 of the Public Protector Act, which is a document setting out the remuneration, allowances and other conditions of employment determined by the Public Protector in terms of this section, shall be tabled in the National Assembly within 14 days after such determination. Presumably you do determinations annually. I don't remember ever seeing one. I don't know if you can just explain about the implementation of that. Then another point, because it also relates to the implementation of the Act, your latest report to the point, or can't remember what it was, I heard Mr. Malema on the radio complaining that he'd been found guilty in absentia. Was he given an opportunity as required by Section 7.9 of the Act? But maybe if you could just respond to that. And then the broader question, you know, I think is are you making a difference? Are you making as much of a difference as you should be? And I think that's the question that you've got to look at, and your office has to look at, and we've all got to look at. And you're working very hard, we can see that. But I still have questions in that, are you not falling into the whole silo approach of that most other, if not most all, government departments seem to fall into? So we have been raising the issue with you for some time of we want to know trends. In the first budget review process that we did in 2010, we said is it not possible to provide a more accurate picture of the range of issues captured on the 44 reports produced? The presentation of the information of the reports is not particularly helpful in understanding how the Public Protector is fulfilling its mandates. And then this question that has come up here, minimal information is provided on the responses of organs of state to the recommendations made in the Public Protector reports. How is implementation of the recommendations monitored? Are time frames provided? We heard your point, which I think you made a while ago, having a requirement that responses to Public Protect findings must be put into the annual reports. And that's something we can look at, but we need a more effective monitoring. I think the point I'm trying to make is that you're looking hard, but you're not, if you take the justice issues, you're not telling us what the problems are that you're finding. And that's something we've been saying over the years, since 2010. You're not telling us who's not performing. Your suggestion with the RDP Howard's report is you'll come and present it to us. I think you're also not understanding the issue of Parliament sufficiently. It's no point presenting that to us. The Department of Human Settlements does not count to us. It's a very good idea to present that report, present it to the Human Settlements Portfolio Committee. Okay, and that is what you should be doing. And I do feel I've been raising it for a number of years now, and we just don't seem to be, we seem to be talking past each other. So similarly, on the issues relating to justice, those are the issues that we want reports on. And I think that we've got to look at a real way of making that more effective. We know that the public have a lot of problems with Home Affairs. It's referred to in your report. Have you ever had an engagement with the Home Affairs Portfolio Committee to say these are the systemic problems that we find in the department? And if so, when was that?
Or present them with a more detailed,
you know, report. Yeah, to look at. Because, for example, that earlier report I referred to, report number 4 on the President's Fund, I mean, I think that just shows. That should have come to us. You actually should have approached us when you started it to say, look, we're investigating this. We understand you are, might have started in 2008, but we understand, we hear that you have been dealing with this matter. Can we engage with you on it? But anyway, the point I'm really trying to make is, I think the question for me is, are you as effective? Are you making a difference? And if you are making a difference, I mean, you're making a difference to individual people, but you've got to make more of a difference. And that basically means, I think, a better information to Parliament of Oversight Portfolio Committees, and then also this issue we've been asking for, the responses of the organs of state, which we asked way back in 2010. So check us those points.
I mean, I think also with the issue of the departments that aren't responding to you when they're supposed to, and I mean, I think it might be one of you submit the separate reports to each of those departments for that, to the portfolio committee for each of those, so they can take it on with the department. Thanks.
Just one from me. You may have been asked this during a break by whoever. You referred to 7 ongoing investigations without providing details. We really want to know what those investigations are. Simply said, there are 7 ongoing investigations, full stop. No additional details. Can we get those details?
Thank you, Honourable Members. I will start with the systemic ones. I have just read the list, Honourable Members. It's with the RCP, the panel events, that was the list. And in the report, we provide the... In the report itself, we indicate what investigations we identified and the process started, and then ones that were concluded. Thank you, Honourable Member. On the issue of are we making a difference, that's a question that has to be answered by Parliament and by the people of South Africa and by the government that we're helping. The feedback we've received so far is that we are making a difference, but I can't answer for Parliament. We account to Parliament. I can say from where I'm sitting, we are making a difference. Through the reports that were done, for example, such as against the rules and the executive ethics matters, we have made a systemic impact, not individual impact. It was through those investigations that government became alive to the fact that public works was dysfunctional. The whole leasing program in government is dysfunctional. And it was through that process that Treasury immediately issued new regulations around the handling of this of figures that are certain amount of money, and said these ones would be supervised by Treasury, and that was because of the recommendations that had been made as part of the remedial action. On executive ethics matters, the matters that we've dealt with have indicated that there are some problems around interpretation of certain benefits, and sometimes accidentally people then exceed their benefits, and some obviously just violated, and we brought that to the attention, and that led to a process that was already being undertaken, but a process that then included some of the weaknesses that were pointed out around compliance with the ministerial handbook. Municipalities that we've dealt with, Glimmer of Hope, not only did we investigate maladministration, we worked with them to make sure that they got the necessary capacity and understanding of the rules around financial management, procurement management, asset management. And when we left there, there was a glimmer of hope. That's why that report was titled Glimmer of Hope. And I was speaking to the Minister of COFDA, who wanted us to just go back and see whether the glimmer of hope is still moving in the right direction. From where I'm sitting, we're making a difference, not just through the reports. Through the other cases that we've dealt with, out of the 27,000 that we're talking about, a lot of them are resolved through day-to-day contact. We talk about the problem with the organs of speech, and we work with them to resolve it. In fact, that is the beauty of an ombudsman, is that it's not just about red carding. It's also about an opportunity to engage and an opportunity to capacitate around what is the right way of doing business. And we do that on a day-to-day basis. And then even when we report, we deal with systemic observations. I spoke about LASA, for example, to say there's been a huge difference. You can see that difference being done. Home Affairs, much as there are difficulties in Home Affairs, but there are problems that have been solved. One of the things we started with was the duplicate ID problem. And we've been holding each other since. There are still problems in certain areas at Home Affairs, but we're engaging. We meet with the GG Home Affairs. We have a program that allows my service delivery branch to meet with the DG Home Affairs on a regular basis. These are scheduled meetings to talk to. That's why we're not issuing a lot of reports, because these issues are handled at the level of bilateral. About the trends that are reflected in the report, in my written report, honourable members, there is a part of the report that talks to trends for noting and action to Parliament. That is page 33. Where we say that the work of the public protector is not only to exact accountability and justice in respect of specific cases, but also to act as a catalyst for change with a view to entrenching good governance or good administration as a way of life. And with regard
to the report, it's a specific detail. That is the issue that we've been asking for. You know, so I've read page 33 and page 34, but it's the detail.
Right, because we're giving you trends. You see, in terms of the trend analysis, we're giving you broad overviews, but we can supply them the details. Because here we were doing a trend observation. A trend observation says here, we say that the patterns revealed by cases referred to by the public protector in the period under review point to a need for strengthening financial and procurement systems, leadership and disciplinary mechanisms, particularly at local government level. Many of the complaints relate to failure to implement obvious findings, such as those of the Auditor General and forensic experts. And that's a serious problem. Government, the Auditor General makes findings and even talks to all of us about what we need to change. Some of us try to make sure that the following year is better than the other. Others just leave it. And the Auditor General says so himself. Then there are those who pay money to hire forensic experts when people insist that an investigation should be done. An investigation is done, the report is not implemented. So those are the trends that we're talking about. So here we were giving you just a trends analysis. If you want the trends to then also go with specifics and say the trends at the Department of Justice are as follows. at the specific municipalities are as follows. We can make the terms more detailed.
Yes. Because, Chair, I mean, that's the nub of it. I mean, the issue of I think all parliamentary committees do question departments on the implementation of the Auditor General reports, and it definitely forms the basis of the department's presentation on its annual report. So that's what we know. We don't need the public protector to tell us. The issue is that, for example, you have all these cases against the involving justice. What do we say when the department comes to us tomorrow, I mean next week, what do we say to them? Do we say to them, oh, you must have better financial controls? Well, we do that already. But what do we do in terms of, in relation to what you are picking up? When the Master's Office and the Chief Master come, what do we say to them? Your issues with LASA, we've never got any report. I'm glad to say to hear that they've improved. We always have glowing annual reports from LASA, but we've never heard what you've been investigating. So that's the issue. And the difficulty, Chair, is we've been asking this for the last 3 years, and we just seem to be talking past each other. And, my question was obviously you're making a difference, but is it enough of a difference? My question was twofold, and I think it could be a greater difference if there was a more substantial engagement with the parliamentary committees on the issues.
Thank you. Honourable Jeffrey, when we started, you raised the issue of LASA and the Department of Justice, and we promised that we're going to provide that information. I just wanted to go on this issue and say we have said here another key pattern relates to compliance with supply chain requirements, particularly competitive processes and due diligence in regards to reasonable pricing and quality assurance. It cannot be right that the state ends up paying far above retail prices, whereas it should pay much less by leveraging its bulk buying capacity. Although management of state office leasing is a major source of concern during the period under review, similar patterns of concern are indicated in other supply chain areas, including the procurement of hospital equipment and provisional services. Lack of compliance with strategic plans and integrated development plans, an issue highlighted in the Against the Rules and Glimmer of Hope report, is another area that needs urgent attention. Not only are such anomalies associated with possible corruption, but such distortions have serious implications for government budget priorities and the achievement of the constitutional priorities and national development goals that would have informed budget allocation. This has added implications for the achievement of priorities such as socioeconomic rights and Millennium Development Goals. Finally, I say ethical governance increasingly emerges as an issue. Concerns are not confined to overt violations of the Executive Ethics Code. The right to a decision is a major source of many of the complaints dealt with. In this context of edginess in society, it is important that promises are kept and that regular channels of communication and accountability to communities are maintained. A related issue is ensuring that outcomes of the public protective processes and those of the Auditor General are effectively used as conduits to strengthen public accountability and to facilitate constructive dialogue between the people and the state, and not as gates to nowhere. That was my sense, that because of the Justice Portfolio Committee being the committee we report to. In other countries, of course, the public protector would report to a governance committee. So it has a jurisdiction over all issues related to governance. That's why we bring it here. But your suggestion to us that we should also engage with the specific portfolio committee, which we think is an excellent idea. In the process with it, we have engaged with legislatures. Every year we engage with legislators, we give them feedback about what are the systemic issues they should give attention to. We engage with also the executives in that province, and we ask for the provincial executive committee every year to give them feedback, because yes, our intention is not just to deal with the cases in point, it's to act as a catalyst for change, to point out to those who are charged with governing what are the deficiencies that are undermining their own intentions, and then give them an opportunity to fix those things Cabinet, we have requested a meeting with Cabinet. We are meeting with them on the 26th. I think we're meeting with them on the 26th of this month. So we do our part, we play our part in making sure that the structures that are concerned with these issues are given an opportunity to understand what should they be worried about and what should they do. And it was not to God that we're putting out all of this, and but with regard to specifics, we will in future provide those specifics.
The question about the discrepancy between the complaints carried over and received and the number investigated? I'll count those received and carried over, add up to 26.2, but you say you've investigated
27.3. We talk about cases that we handled in its entirety. When our own internal, our own report to the Auditor General initially spoke about 26,000, that's how my normal public reports talk about 26,000, 26,000. When these processes were audited, the Auditor General pulled out 1,147 cases that are internal transfers that would move from KZN to Pretoria. Those are the ones that have been creating the distortion. When I do my own public speaking, the narrative is always around 26,000. Because in terms of what came totally from outside, we're talking about 26,000. If you look at the page, let's show page, what was the report, the slide on statistical overview. It shows the total distribution of everything.
But are they then duplicate cases? I mean, it then appears that they're duplicate. So you would have a case coming into KZN and then being transferred to Gauteng, and then it's one case but then reflecting as two on the 27,000.
No, it's not reflecting as this. It's just, I think they accounted for the fact that there was processing of the case. It's the same case moving from one. It's not a duplicate. In other words, from our point of view, there were 26,000 cases. But within those 26,000 cases, the cases moved from one place to another. Yes. But that's the Auditor General's insistence that we should repeat it this way. In my own speeches, I'm always talking about 26,000, but for the annual report, we had to talk about this. Cases is reflected. Here is the table. There is the statistical overview of cases is on the table. That will show you where everything comes from. That is the statistical overview. Yes, it shows, Honourable Jeffrey, because it's showing the. Yes. In fact, these figures were changed. The original figures as reflected by us were 26,000. Yes. Yes. Our own figures that we submitted at the end of our own process would show 26,000. Thank you. The Auditor General so that we have the proper reflection. But basically, they were talking about 26,000. Although, obviously, from a handling point of view, there's a question of accounting for the time of people, because from moving it from one place to another, you account for the time that the person has taken. But it doesn't account for, in terms of our accessibility to the people of South Africa. We are saying, in the year under review, we received 20,000, and then we had carried over the other cases from the previous year. Thank you.
20, Mr. Malema and claiming that he's being found guilty in absentia, and then that technical staff allowances.
Thank you. In terms of staff, I'll start with that one. We are not yet making a determination by the public protector. We're still benchmarking according to the public service. We have been speaking with the Auditor General about moving to a system where we determine our own salaries as the Act gives me the power to do so. When the institution started, it was deemed that it did have the capacity to determine its own part of the scale. It has been a problem in regard to retaining investigators, though. So with the advice of the Auditor General and hopefully with his guidance, which he has offered, we are going to migrate. But that's another question that the CEO is going to elaborate on. Then I come to Mr. Malema. I'm so glad you asked that question because my staff had prepared yesterday a press statement for it, which I decided not to release, but it's here, so we can give it to you, actually, the exact press statement, because Mr. Malema is not telling the truth. Mm-hmm. On section 160 of the report, it's very clear what the process was. In this written report that he's talking about, page 160 of the report, it says specifically what we did. Section 79 of the Public Protector, it says that the Public Protector has to inform a person if there is an intention by the Public Protector to make other findings against that person. And previously, we would send you one page, a few lines, a paragraph that says we intend to make other findings against you, and please address us on this issue. Just on this specific issue, we would indicate to you what other findings. When I came in, we decided to give you a whole provisional report that helps you to identify on what basis am I likely to make an adverse finding against you. We give a provisional report to parties involved in the dispute. So it will be given to complainants and respondents and any other person against whom an adverse report is going to be given. The interesting thing is that Mr. Malema is the one who's been telling people that he got this report. I remember being interviewed by BBC. I remember having been interviewed by various news agencies and refusing to indicate whether or not he got the report. Because for me, that would be disclosing who in the report am I intending to make other findings against. So I don't disclose who I gave a report to during the investigation. And as far as I'm concerned, a provisional report is part of investigation documents. So he told the whole world that he got the provisional report. He comes back now and says he wasn't informed. After he received the provisional report, which was around, if somebody can just get me the page 160 of the report, if you do have it, mine is there, but it's in a different, it's in my bag in the car. In the report, I detailed that the report was given around, I think it was around the 3rd of August to Mr. Malema. Mr. Malema came back to my office on around, I think, the 13th or so of August. Now I'm speaking on top of my head, but around that time, he came back and said and complained that he had not been interviewed and that in any event, though, the findings he said he had not been interviewed and he knows that there are observations that are made that have an impact on Ratanang Family Trust, where he's a trustee. We responded back to Mr. Malema on the following day. I think he wrote on the 13th, we responded immediately on the 14th to indicate to him, his lawyer was Khan something, the Khan attorneys who were writing on his behalf. We indicated that the purpose of giving you a provisional report is to indicate that there may be findings that are adverse to you or a company of interest to you. And the letter that accompanies the provisional report specifically refers to Section 79. That says, in terms of Section 79, this is what I'm supposed to do. I'm accordingly giving you a copy of the report. And then I indicated that the whole idea of giving him the report was to make sure that he indicates if he wants to give me any additional information that would prevent the adverse findings. He reported back to me on the 30th, either 30th or 31st of August, saying he knows that and he's not. He will not be availing himself for an interview. In our response on the 14th, indicated why we give provisional reports, and then we say if he would like to be interviewed, I would like to interview him. He responded in writing to say he would not like to be interviewed. That's why then I am shocked that Mr. Malema is saying he was not given his Section 79 right. Lastly, Section 79 says the communication to somebody who against whom you're going to, you're making other findings, the modus of communication should be as the Public Protector deems it. So I may choose to have an interview, I may choose to give you a report. But other thing to be noted is that in this report, there isn't anything that speaks to Mr. Malema specifically. The report talks to Ratanang Family Trust having received more than 2.17 million rand. The report also talks about a Ratanang farm having been bought. And all of that information was not coming from interviews. It wasn't something that could be refuted by someone. It came from bank statements that were submitted to us by the sole director of On Point. He gave us the bank statements. We read the bank statements. So we just downloaded exactly what is in the bank statements, and we still have those bank statements. We didn't say it was improper for the money to be given to the Ratanang Trust. It didn't say it was improper for the Sundown property to be given the money that it was given, or the Sandton property to be given. All we said was that money came from On Point, because that's what the bank statement said, and that the money that On Point got, it got it unlawfully from a tender that was issued on the basis of fraud, and that some of the money that On Point got, it got it on the basis of corruption based on those kickbacks that were based on the back-to-back agreement. So that was not really a finding that could be refuted, because that was factual based on the document. But in any event, we did give him an opportunity, honestly, to address me, and he chose not to.
Mr. Jeffrey.
I think the problem may relate to the interpretation of Section 7.9, in that you are saying, look, what you do is you conduct your investigation, and then you send out your draft report to any person who may be affected. I think you send it out to the complainant as well. But I think the issue may be that surely when you're... But in that draft report is a provisional, a preliminary finding. Surely the issue should be, before you've got to the stage of drafting that preliminary finding, should you not be interviewing the people to hear their side of the story? So I'm not just talking about Mr. Malema's case, I'm talking about generally across the board. In this particular case, you it seems you didn't interview Mr. Malema until you're only actually talking about the fact that you sent in the preliminary report. And it doesn't appear as though you did conduct any interview with him or have any contact with him before. I haven't read the report, I must be honest, but it, as far as I understand, the Ratanang Family Trust is Mr. Malema and your grandmother. But in other words, so should there not have been an interview with Mr. Malema prior to your compiling the preliminary report? And is that maybe not what he's talking about?
Firstly, you're right that we should interview people before we make findings against them, and that's exactly what we do. We didn't interview the activities of the Ratanang Family Trust. That's what I was explaining earlier. We interrogated the activities of On Point. And we wrote to On Point requesting to meet with the directors of On Point. And On Point made its own choice to send Mr. Gwangwa and two lawyers that I personally interviewed. Surely if On Point wanted Mr. Malema to be part of that meeting, On Point could have brought Mr. Malema to be part of that meeting. Because we were interrogating a tender that was given by the Department of Roads and Transport. In my narrative, I simply talk to what happened to the money that On Point got. And then, based on the bank statements that were supplied by On Point, I indicate that the money went, some of it went to, a lot of it went to the Ratanang Family Trust, some of it went to the Ratanang Farm, some of it went into the Sundown property. I don't even say that it is a property of Ms. Malema, because the bank statements that they gave me don't say that the Sundown property is Mr. Malema's property. The sentence in the Sundown property is on Mr. Malema. I just write it as a document that was supplied to me by Mr. Gwangwa. And some of the stuff that I repeat in the report are just statements made by Mr. Gwangwa. And we repeat the verbatim where Mr. Gwangwa says Mr. Malema is a business person who is well connected. Any business would be happy to have with him is an asset. That's what Mr. Gwangwa said, and we just write it. It is because Mr. Gwangwa was sent by On Point. On Point is owned by Golda Investments. Golda Investments is owned by the Rahanang Family Trust and the Gwangwa Family Trust. Surely it was up to the owner of On Point, the Gilda investment, to decide who comes to address me. It wasn't my job to decide that they should send a different person. Of course, I interview people for two reasons, honorable members. I only interview you if I need information from you or if I think you can refuse something. If something is a blank statement that has been submitted by you, what could you possibly refute? I will give you the statement that was prepared by my staff just to try to explain from this side why initially Mr. Maguma was not interviewed. And then after he was, after we thought that obviously because he owns or his family owns the Rahanang Family Trust, he might have an interest. We then decided to give him the hotel we gave him. But just in summary, yes, we don't only alert you to potential adverse findings at the point of the provisional report. That's why we interviewed Mr. Kwangwa. And if you read all of the other reports that have issued recently, I interviewed all of those people myself, especially the ones that we're about to have adverse findings against them. I interviewed them personally and then in addition gave them a provisional report. Thank you.
Advocate Maransela, like others, I have not read the report, but you said today that there is corruption. Yes. And that being the case, then, are you recommending, will you recommend that criminal charges be laid?
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. We have recommended that criminal charges be laid, which also, again, disputes what Mr. Malema is saying. I am not a court of law that can find you guilty of crime. The Public Protector Act gives me the powers to indicate my opinion. So the report is written in that way. I don't say I find them guilty of corruption. I say, in terms of the Public Protector Act, Section 6.4, I am of the opinion that corruption was corruption in the way the PMU operated, or On Point as PMU operated. And I also express that I'm of the opinion that the tender was awarded under fraudulent purposes. I then refer the letter to the NPA, meaning that it has still to be determined by a court of law. I then also ask the Hawks with the NPA to investigate the suspicious circumstances under which this tender, which should never have been awarded, was not at least awarded. Because surely, if a company is 1 month old, you don't even need serious due diligence to know that it shouldn't get this tender. So I was worried, why was it given this tender if it wasn't preferential treatment? Again, I'm not saying it's corrupt. I am saying somebody else should look into it and come back to us and say, am I right in suspecting that there was an improper relationship there?
That recommendation is gone to Hawks and the NPA.
Yes, Honourable Chair.
Ms. Adams.
Thank you, Chairperson. Ma'am, a few months ago, Melissa Blayton Zimonde accused your office of being selective in your investigations. I don't know if that would still be subpoenaed now with the Malema investigation, but now, a few months down the line, Mr. Malema, who is an ordinary member of the public, say that you didn't hear his side of the story. I just read an article now where another member of the public, some property tycoon, is basically making the same allegation that the law agencies and your office included is selective in deciding which investigation must take place and which not. So my question to you is, on what basis did you decide to do the investigation of the Malema issue or this On Point tender? Did you jump the queue or is there a sort of process? On what basis do you decide which investigation is more urgent than the other one? Thank you.
Because it has a consequence of a complaint received.
Yes, there was a complaint, but Honourable Adams, I'm grateful that you asked that question because it gives me an opportunity to talk about the intake, assessment and distribution process in my office. first thing, when Honorable Blessing Bemange made this accusation the first time, I indicated that I would ask him for answers, and I never did. When he made the same accusation the second time, I wrote to him, asking him to specify which investigations that were requested by the NCD I ignored, and which one of the DA jumped the queue. I am still waiting for an answer. I'm glad you gave me an opportunity to ask that question, because when Honorable Zimande does provide the answer, I would like this portfolio committee to interrogate it. Because if it was a complaint or an allegation made by a member of the executive, in terms of Section 181(3) of the Constitution, both sides of state have to support institutions established to support constitutional democracy, and they're not supposed to undermine them or render them ineffective. And if people make those allegations without any evidence, they are creating an impression that we're preferring certain people. But yes, the jury is still out, Honorable Chairperson, until Honorable Zimande shows it. I will then use this opportunity to go then to explain the intake and assessment process. I have 20 offices across the country. We have a process where complaints are not filed centrally in the Public Protector Office. They're filed in all of these centers. They assess and they decide based on my delegations on what comes in, but with the same template. And it's brought up in the intake and assessment process where I can say to them, no, what you rejected, maybe you shouldn't have rejected. It's mostly rejections that I always worry about, especially for the small person, and because mostly my staff would say this thing is older than 7 years, is older than 5 years. So for me, if the justice considerations are in favor of the person, even if it's an old matter, I will take it. I would insist that we take it, even though it's a little bit older than it should be. On the cases that involve the other parties, I don't really interfere. When we take these matters, then once we are in, there are two things that we have to do now. Once we've decided that we have jurisdiction, we have to decide, will we handle it ourselves, or will we ask the Human Rights Commission to handle it, or the Public Service Commission, the SIU, or some of the other institutions. That is done in the provinces. Again, the assessment process is lifted to me for information. We used to have a daily intake system when our SCM had not really, gone to the point where it is right now, where all I can see is on the screen, and then I can write back and say, this can't be done. But at this stage, I only get it after saying myself, and it's in the system. So it's not true that I sit there and then just say, but you are not, you don't belong to your opposition party, then I'm not going to take your case. I don't have, I have those powers in terms of the X, but the system as it is decentralized. Now, on the matters that come to head office, everything goes to the intake, assessment, and customer service team. They assess, and then it is brought to me every Friday. Like today, the report that you're going to get on Monday will be the report that I'm going to get. Then I see to them, and then we look at it and say, I was right or wrong in taking jurisdiction, shooting somebody else taking. Then it's given to branches. Once it's accepted, it goes to branches, and the branch appoints an investigator to take care of this matter. When it comes to speed, then, it really often depends on the capacity of each investigator. So one investigator may work faster. I work with them, but I'm not everywhere, because I don't think the AIT expected me to be everywhere. It expected me to do some of it. I do some of the interviews. It expected me to provide guidance. It also expected me to make the final decisions in terms of the report. So I work with the team, and then some move after some move. But if you look at the Malema investigation, it took more than a year. We were expected to conclude it within 3 months. We also thought we could conclude it within 3 months. But because we could not free the hands of the investigators so that they could just focus on this investigation, like all other investigations, it found itself going a bit over, or much over the period. At some stage, we were even considering suspending the contract, and we couldn't suspend it because it was already operational, which was a good thing because we didn't take the 3 months we originally anticipated. So with finality, I do not prioritize cases according to who is involved. Take the Gaza investigation. Somebody was asking me, shouldn't you have prioritized this investigation? We received it in December last year. It was in the system, but we didn't have free hands. And to the extent of our ability, we are trying to make sure that it doesn't age over a year. That's another thing we do. We do try, though, to make sure that cases don't age beyond 1 year. So around this time, we see and we look at all of the cases and say which ones are likely to be older than a year at the end of March. And we will obviously try to put all hands on deck in respect of those cases. But it has nothing to do with who are the parties and who are the complainants. Thank you, Honourable Adams.
Mr. Sibanyan.
In conclusion, I'm considering I'm closing it.
Really?
No, it's on light notes.
Okay.
Public protector, I think public protector, what would you say if people are saying as an institution, public protector, you should not be seen attending functions or political parties and the like?
Thank you, Honourable Sibanyan. I did hear that from parties, and I had intended to discuss it when I finally met the political parties, and somehow we forgot to include it in the agenda to see whether that was the general view that was shared. But I want to state again in this parliament and with the presence in the presence of the DA, I did not attend the DA meeting. I attended the DAW meeting, and I have to explain that our acceptance of that invitation was based on an understanding that we are attending a women's wing of an organization. The same way that had you been invited by the Women's Brigade or the IFP, we would have gone because it was Women's Fund. If we had been invited by the ANC Women's League, we would have gone. And the invitation and the program in that meeting, which I would ask the people who invited me in PE to show, it was built as a rally, but it was not a political rally. I think it was rally in name, but it was a workshop. It was a workshop where the women had to be told about their rights in the constitutions and the mechanisms in place for them to assert those rights, and the place of the public protector is one of those mechanisms, and that was the speech I gave. Aside from that, there were no political speeches. They had a woman who was abused, a victim of domestic violence, who spoke about her experiences as an abused woman and how the system somehow had failed her. We had another woman who spoke about how the system had failed her, including the public protector on housing. She had one of those aging infrastructure, the old houses in government, and she was saying that she has been engaged in this process and she has been with the public protector for 1 year and even the public protector has not produced any results. Which obviously we have to explain that of course we investigate, but we can't obviously force the people to leave the house, you know, at the time when we need it. We keep engaging. So those are the three things in general. It was a workshop, Honourable Sibanyan. It was not a rally, although it is known as a rally. And we attended it on that basis. But I would like maybe the Justice Portfolio Committee in my absence to debate this thing and make its own suggestions if it feels that whether it's Christian wing of a political party, if I'm invited to speak about my office, I should attend. I'm happy to consider that. Obviously, ultimately, it's my choice what I do, but there has been a fallout on this matter, and I don't want a fallout. I want all stakeholders to believe that the public protector is neutral. And if not attending anything, COSATU, if they invite us to a workers' workshop where we have to tell workshops and the workers about the public protector as an institution they work with, if the feeling is that we shouldn't attend because COSATU is affiliated to the ANC, I don't know where to draw the lines. But we are happy to engage, we are happy to be advised, and at the end of the day, make a decision that will make sure that the perception of neutrality of my office is maintained. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Jeffrey and Mr. Schaefer.
Yeah. Look, I think that it is very, generally government officials are not meant to speak at party events.
and whether it's a youth, or one of the, I don't know what DAWN stands for, but I mean it's a party,
it's a
women's network, or it's a party event. So where you go to speak to DAWN or DASL or whatever, it's a political party event. I mean, would you, for example, on Youth Day, if you did happen to be invited to go and speak at a Youth League event on youth rights, I don't think it would really be appropriate, similarly with the with any other party. So I think it's something that, I mean, we can debate further, but I think that it's something to be careful of. I would have seen that limited political party, so a trade union, whether it's COSATU or any other trade union, it's not a political party. It's not a political party. But I think it did expose a bit of a false line.
I just want to indicate, honourable members, that before this event, I would have honestly, before the ANC's concern about the DAWN event, I would have attended an ANC Youth League event. If it was purely on rights issues, because the event that I attended was not an event where there was politics discussed and then there was a slot for the public protector. It's an event that I attended that was purely on rights issues. So before this, yes, I would have attended an ANC Youth League event that was on rights issues. But after this, I seek guidance. In fact, after this, I was invited by a Christian wing, a women's Christian wing of a political party. And because of this fallout, I wasn't able to respond appropriately. Fortunately, I wasn't available on that day. So that is how the matter was resolved. So I'm happy, as I said, Honourable Jeffrey, to get views. But about government officials being not allowed to attend political party events, firstly, I didn't know this was a political party event. As I said, it was the women's wing of the political party, but focusing on rights issues. I saw it as an issue of making sure that the public protector is accessible to all persons and communities, and that's how we record. And we debated actually in the team before I accepted the event to say, how do we justify it? Because everything we do, we justify it and say, is it in our mandate? Will it actually help us reach our own goals, our own strategic goals? And one of our strategic goals is to be accessible to all persons and communities. But second, Honourable Jeffrey, I'm not a public official. I'm a public office bearer. So I don't know really where is that rule. I would like to see that rule, because if there's a rule, then I violated a rule. Yes.
Violated a rule. It's an issue. You're a public office bearer, not a public servant. But the issue is the reason that it should be happening is because of perceptions. And I do unfortunately find it a little bit naive that a woman's component or a youth component of a political party or political organization is not a political organization.
Little being naive than Honourable Jeffrey, because that is exactly what Howard received it. And it's not even a decision I took it in the little corner. It's a decision that we set as a team, and based on that team decision, obviously the ultimate decision was mine, but we felt that it was the right thing to do. But now that we have heard this kind of outcry from the ANC, of course we are taking that into account. Thank you.
But thank you so much. Can I just please clarify, did you or do not also attend the ANC 100-year centenary celebration? And then I need to say something else. You've had it more than time.
Honourable Schaefer, I did attend the ANC centenary celebration. I was invited and I attended. And at that stage, again, I didn't think that it was improper. But in the light of what has happened, my team and I are looking at everything that has happened and looking at it in terms of perceptions and in terms of making sure that nothing undermines our duty to begin to be impartial.
Thank you for your continuing. Thank you very much for that, because that's what I understood. So the point is, I think it is a worthwhile point debating whether you should or not, because I do think it's important that you are seen to be independent. But the fact of the matter is, if you weren't, you were at an AFC and a DA function at the end of the day. So if there's any impropriety has been done on both sides, which actually enhances your meeting, as far as I'm concerned. But I do think it's worth discussing. So we mustn't be hypocritical about saying we went to a DA event because it wasn't an ANC event. But I do think it's worth discussing it at another occasion.
Just for the record, I mean, the ANC event was a centenary. You did not speak there. You did speak at the DA event. And the ANC event was attended by a large number of heads of state. But the difference is, I mean, the particular issue is speaking, being on the platform, adding credence to that that party. But it's something to debate. But I do think the attending the centenary celebration of the ANC, along with a large number of people, including many foreign heads of state, Dawn? Dawn event and being on the platform and speaking a different.
What we're doing now is what we said we should do on another occasion, and that's debate the matter. Now, madam, you are requesting to say something on a lighter note. My fear is you're going to stimulate further discussion.
During one of the conversations that we heard with some of the stakeholders, a stakeholder said that he understands my defense that we did this as part of our accessibility because we are required by the Constitution to be accessible to all persons and communities. He then suggested that the way forward is that government should give us enough money for our outreach programs so that we don't leverage stakeholder relationships to make sure that we're accessible to all persons and communities. So we ask this committee to back our request for additional resources.
All right. Okay, you've succeeded in bringing it back to the spirit we had before this matter was raised, because I was fearful that we were going to end on a very damp note. Public Protector, to you and your team, the work you do is of... Sorry?
Make sure that we leave out the 5 million that we're supposed to answer.
Do you want to answer it?
No, it's fine. The house is fine. Just an answer. Okay.
All right. You can send us a certain response to that. Because my understanding, my very poor bookkeeping tells me that when your liabilities exceed your assets, you're effectively bankrupt. But you're always insolvent, but bankrupt. Same thing. All right. We're the experts. All right. Can we close now? All right. We've had a very lengthy and I think fruitful engagement. We want to thank you for that. I wasn't sure about the Malem issue, where we can discuss it. So, when you said you badly raised it, I thought, well, fine, then we're on safe ground. So I sincerely hope nobody takes issue with us. We are prejudging matters. We're not. We're simply trying to get clarity, if nothing else. We still believe that what you're doing is of utmost importance. And we would urge you to continue in the same vein. From our side, we've not had a chance as a committee. Journalists ask me whether we're going to give you the money you're asking for. I said, but we've only just received requests now. And so I would need to afford my members an opportunity to apply their minds to it and then to decide whether they should or shouldn't. And that is my response now to that. So that it's not misunderstood and they leave you saying, well, they haven't decided, so that means she's not getting it. I'm not saying that. Please leave this place with our very good wishes. And we continue to encourage the excellent work you're doing. And thank you for appearing before us. All right, we're adjourned.